You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And. My guest today is Danigal Goldthwaite-Young, who is a professor in the Department of Communications at the University of Delaware. Her research interests include political media effects, public opinion, political satire, and the psychology of political humor. In addition to her books Irony and Outrage and Wrong, Young's research has been published in numerous journals, including Media Psychology, Political Communication, International Journey of Press Politics, Journal of Broadcasting and Electronic Media, and Mass Media and Society. She's also an improviser, so we have a lot to talk about. Enjoy the pod.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The car on the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops. But over time, the expectation.
Danny Young, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Kelly. I'm so excited to talk today.
All right. I was trying to decide where to start this conversation. And so if you'll indulge me, I want to tell you a story and then get your reaction. I'm going to get your reaction to that story.
It's great.
So this is like 1994, and I'm producing a show on the Second City main stage that would go on to be called Are You Now or Have You Ever Been Mellow? And there was a scene that the cast came up with early in the process called Spelling Bee, and it was hilarious. Killer scene, like this was like a showstopper. It's probably gonna end the first act or close the show. And so the scene is, it's a kids' national spelling bee, and it's hosted by two offstage voices, a guy named David Rosowski and a guy named Stephen Colbert. And basically they torture every kid by giving them words to spell that will upset them. So Steve Carell is the nervous kid who has to spell anxiety. Ruth Rudnick is the kid with massive dental hardware who has to spell saliva. And then it gets to Jackie Hoffman, who people might know from Only Murders in the Building. And she's a Jewish kid. And Colbert says, your word is compass. And she says, can you use that in a sentence? And Colbert says, sure. Your people killed Jesus. Compass. Very big laugh. Very big laugh. So later, like in the process, like 2 or 3 weeks in the process, maybe 4, Colbert comes to my office and he wants to kill the scene. He wants to take it out of the show. Which seemed crazy because it got such a huge response. And he said, and I am quoting him here, I seem to remember the quote, it gets the wrong kind of laughs. It gets blood in the mouth laughs. So I worked my creative producer jiu-jitsu and we kept the scene in the show. But I will always remember this hard conversation about satire and the responsibility of the satirist to make sure an audience understands the commentary and the humor, especially as my wife and I are in bed watching the very first Colbert Report.
Amazing.
That's the story.
Amazing. I think that he probably has an innate sense. I bet that it actually comes from his religious faith.
Yep.
Right? His Catholic faith, which is very much rooted in sort of a humility. I guess, you know, it doesn't surprise me that he would have said that and perhaps noticed it at a time in a moment when other people hadn't, because that's kind of, it seems to me that that's something that he would be very aware of. I think that we know that he was aware of the sort of potential for even his character on the Colbert Report to be perhaps putting blood in the mouths of people. I think before anyone else was. You know, obviously he started that character on The Daily Show, and it just was so well received. I mean, people loved it. And then to have that as sort of a headliner was such a bold move, because it's like, can you actually just do an entire show in ironic character?
Didn't seem so.
And he did. And he did it. But, you know, I think what you're alluding to is in my first book, I mentioned his interview with Terry Gross on Fresh Air. Mm-hmm. And he alluded to the fact that he knew that if he wasn't very, very careful with how he played that character, that it could hurt people. I think that was his expression. And she pushed him on that, which, you know, whenever you're listening to Fresh Air, you're like, Terry, ask them this next, you know? And she did. Yeah. She's like, what is that? What do you mean? And he basically said, if you're not really careful when you're playing these sort of ironic satirical bits, you can actually serve to reinforce or support the very ideas that you're trying to challenge, basically. That's not a direct quote, but so he knew. And I think amazing satirists do know. Dave Chappelle knew. There's a story of him having that same exact realization was when he was on the set of the Chappelle Show. And it was a sketch where one of the guys on set, a white guy, had just the wrong kind of laugh. And he was like, I don't like this. You know, and a lot of my work has been about the fact that, well, before I started studying the really sad stuff, you know, mis and disinformation, I spent 20 years studying the psychology of satire and the effects of satire on attitudes, behaviors, opinions, and knowledge. And I think one of the things that I keep coming back to, especially with ironic satire, which I think is true of most communicative texts, but especially ironic satire, is that the meaning of the text does not live in the creator of the text. The meaning of the text is out there in the world. And because irony is so ambiguous inherently, and it draws upon pre-existing knowledge that perhaps people don't share and pre-existing biases that perhaps people don't share, then once you put it out into the world, it's kind of, you have to say a little prayer that it's going to do what you want it to do. And especially in our media environment today that's so fragmented, where people who perhaps weren't your intended audience are going to encounter your work, that's a real freaking risk.
Yeah.
You know?
My friend Jen Ellison, who's our sort of creative lead here, and she's taught in my wife's college program, comedy program. She talks about thick laughs and thin laughs. And what she's trying to say to the students is like, you can get an easy laugh off a thin laugh. That's not what you're here for. We want you to do a thick laugh, which is going to be a little bit more tricky, a little bit more interesting. And this goes back to the early days of Second City, where one of the credos was play to the top of your intelligence, which means you can do a dumb joke, but it should be the smartest dumb joke possible. And again, you're going to have that risk of being misinterpreted. And what I found fascinating over my 37 years here at Second City is most of the time, our audiences, who are definitely not all on the left, will come in and just be fine with the show. We are in one of those times right now where that's not the case. And the last time we were in that was when Trump was in office the first time, and when a Gulf War was going on. So there are these moments in time where the audience starts fighting us. And quite honestly, sometimes the actors start fighting the audience, which is never a good recipe for your evening at a comedy theater.
Sure. So when you say, you know, you were in one of those moments when they're not just fine with it, my sense is that, and there are a lot of philosophers of humor that have commented on this for centuries, that humor people cannot enter the state of play if they feel threat.
Yeah.
So I kind of built on that premise for my first book in my explanation for why it is that cultural conservatives seem far less likely to create ironic satire and to explore political ideas through humor in general. And I think it's because we do know that conservatives, psychologically, cultural conservatives, that's not your like small government folks, but the folks who are like conservative on abortion, LGBTQ, immigration, race, crime, whatever, they tend to have higher threat salience. So they're constantly more aware of the potential for interpersonal threat. So my sense has been that the things that fall from that, meaning People with high threat salience tend to have a high need for closure. They want certainty and order and routine. They do not like things that are ambiguous. They like to make decisions quickly and efficiently, because if you're under threat, you know, chewing your cud and thinking a lot exposes you to risk, you know, exposes you to threat. So I've historically thought about that as sort of the mechanism to account for why it is that conservatives are less likely to use play and experimentation to create political meaning. Whereas on the left, cultural liberals, who really, their threshold for interpersonal threat is quite different. Like, yeah, cultural liberals are just not assuming that there are threats out in the world. But I think that that's a luxurious place to sit, because it means that you can think about things for a long time. You can like create riddles and solve riddles and play and experiment, etc. So, but liberals' sort of capacity for threat is not infinite. It's not like they are never threatened. And I think that what we witness under the first Trump administration, and then again now, is that suddenly even that those cultural liberals are like, I might have a very big tolerance for interpersonal threat, but holy shit, I am threatened. And when you are threatened, you cannot engage in the state of play. I think that we've all improvisers have experienced this. When you touch on something that, if, you know, if you're truly improvising and you're just, you know, you're rolfing, you're riffing, you're going to say things, you're going to step on shit that is going to not sit well with someone. And when that happens, it is because you have violated those rules. You have activated some threat perception, which immediately takes the person out of the state of play. And they're like, nope, we don't live here with that idea. So it is very, very, very tricky, you know, because I do comedy sports, which we don't do satire. We don't do, you know, commentary on like social stuff. It's just play.
Yeah, it's games.
And it is a true, it's like going to recess. For me, for the players, and for the audience. Now, there are times when our audience members will suggest things that are political, will suggest things that are topical. And the referee always makes a joke like, oh yeah, because people paid tonight to see the Trump administration on stage. Like, that's why they came, but I feel super lucky because we really keep it outside of the realm of threat. You know?
Yeah, and we live in the crosshairs. I mean, there's in our ETC theater right now, there's a blackout, which is a short little punctuated scene, usually like 30 seconds or so, which is about the Israel-Gaza conflict. On multiple occasions, so I mean three, maybe more now, people have rushed the stage.
No shit.
Yes. And that is uncommon.
What is the reference that is made? Is it just, it's just referenced? It is a,
I'm going to describe it, and it's not going to be funny because I'm describing it. So for the audience,
sure.
It's basically, you see like a young girl at an arcade, and she's doing her thing and playing this game, and then she runs out of whatever tickets. So she goes to her dad, like, I need money. I need more money. I want to play my game, or, you know, I need more money. And then he's like, okay, Israel, and gives her money. So it's about the U.S. funding Israel in that particular, which I find to be a fairly benign. Soft.
Yeah.
Not too pointed. It's no. And it's pointed back at us. So that's also kind of thing. But we're in the zero sum world right now. And this is not just the province of the right, you know, as we've seen. Sure. The left can go to zero sum in their own way, but nothing will make it okay. And we've experienced that before, and with other concepts, and have those discussions with audiences. It's just different now because it's mobilized in a different way, and it's not just an individual on a rare night hearing something they didn't want to hear.
Sure, I think it's interesting because I wonder sometimes when I think about that sort of pushback in the moment, because, you know, I mentioned this in my first book that I was in some game where it was like, you know, movies that were never made for good reason or something like that. And I just, it was right when the movie Schindler's List had come out. And I just, you know, it's improv. So I just said, Schindler's pissed.
Yeah.
And a guy who I was good friends with, who was head of Hillel on campus, got up and tearfully was like, that's not funny. You cannot reference that. And the people started laughing. They thought he was like a Confederate. They thought he was a plant, you know, and then it got worse. And I was like, what is happening? And in that moment, it was just a reference. I wasn't making an argument about anything, right? It was just the existence of that cognitive construct in a place of play that was the violation. So, because I'm thinking the sketch you're talking about, I'm like, oh, maybe are they mad because it the metaphor suggests that Israel is just playing a game, right? That Israel is just, it's just a game for Israel. Maybe that's what they're angry at. But I bet it's not. I bet it is simply the activation, especially the surprise activation, right? They're in a completely different metaphorical place. Like, oh, it's an arcade and a girl and she's asking for money. And then you're like, okay, Israel. And now shift. And now it's like, whoa, you just punched me in the face. And I was not, this violates the contract kind of thing.
Yeah, right.
It could be that.
So my wife has a book coming out this year on her comedy theory that she's developed in her class. And what she essentially, it's different than benign violation that can exist inside it. But basically all comedy has three elements. There's pain, distance, and recognition. She used to call recognition truth. We now call it recognition because it doesn't need to be true. It's the same idea that if you see Scott Adsit walk on stage as a character in the first act and he does a cross in the second act and you laugh at it, you're just laughing because you recognize him from the first act.
Yeah.
No, true. And so I think about this in the concept, and I write about this in my first book, Yes And. We were doing a scene about a year after one of the school shootings, and a kid who was a freshman at Northwestern was in the audience, and she had been at Columbine. She was a senior at Columbine when it happened, and she ran out of the theater crying. I have nothing but empathy for that. She couldn't deal with that. It is different for the rest of us in that audience who weren't there, that we had distance, you know, and we had a different kind of relationship to the pain.
That's so fascinating. I went to a show with my son who follows these YouTubers who do a little bit of improv. It's like edited, but it's called Hive Mind. They're really fun. And we went to a live show for them and they did this little bit. I don't know if it was improvised or if it was a bit where one of them pretended that they were like one of the Twin Towers and the other one was like an airplane. Wow. And I was kind of grossed out. And here, my son's 20 and the audience is mostly in their 20s and they're dying and they're making jokes about how like, okay, we know this is incendiary and whatever, you can't talk. But I'm like, oh, now I get.
Yeah.
The feeling of like, that's a violation, like that's sacred. And to my son, who's 20, he's like, what do you mean? It's just like another thing in a history book. He has complete distance from this event. It's fascinating how our emotional minds and our cognitive minds are so tied together and they shape the experience in a synergistic way. Because it's not one or the other. Like when people ask me, so is humor a cognitive process? Is it an affective or emotional process? And my sort of account for why humor tends to result in less counter-argumentation by the audience, that theory is a very cognitively based theory. That it's like, you know, the process of solving humorous sort of riddles, especially like irony where it's layered, that is really cognitively taxing. Like if you look at fMRIs of what the brain is doing, it is a lot. It's quick, but it's a lot. And so that kind of activity, given our limited bandwidth, means that you're not going to at the same time be saying, is this claim fair? Do they have the right evidence? Do I agree with this? Bah, 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 bah. So my account is very much, it's a cognitive process that humor reduces our ability to counter argue. That's it. But there's another sort of similar theory that suggests that it's really a motivational process, that we see humor as it's like not an appropriate place to get pissed off because, you know, our motivation to counter argue is diminished because we've agreed we're going into the state of play. That's what we're doing here. I think both can be true in different contexts, you know, and in fact, there's some research that shows that my account, the cognitive account, makes a lot of sense and plays out in dense, ironic texts. Like that is what happens when people are like, wait, what does this mean? Like, what is the actual argument? What's happening? And then they're like they're getting the joke, but then the author moves on to some other thing and it's like, oh, okay. Now we're pivoting. You don't have time or space to do that challenge. You know,
I wonder, did you have the epiphany that my wife had and then made me read the book that when Thinking Fast and Slow comes out, you're like, this is improv.
Oh my gosh. From the time I started studying cognitive psych and learning about the brain and priming and all of that, I'm like, I've known this ever since I was doing improv, right?
Yeah.
You know, like how many times do you get on stage and you find yourself going to the same schemas, the same heuristics, the same shit. Cause you're like, oh yeah, my mom, my dad, it's like, that's priming. Those are heuristics. Those are our familiar reference. Of course they're there. Or how many times is it that you go into a show and you're asking for suggestions and my gosh, the number of times that you will get the same suggestion for the same prompt for years and years. How many times can we get Jell-O? Everyone says Jell-O. Jell-O yeah. is universally perceived to be the funny suggestion. Like that yeah. to me is
dildo
like-
Dildo is the one we get here.
Oh yeah, dildo, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we're like a family show, so that would get a shame.
Yeah,
shame,
you got
shame,
the kids,
you know?
They got the kids there, so hopefully-
You got the kids, no, I know. Yeah, exactly. That's, yeah.
But they're very similar sounding, so-
They are, Jell-O and dildo. There you go. Yeah. Which came first, the Jell-O or the dildo? I don't know, Kelly.
I don't know either. And I am unhappy. This is where the conversation went.
Actually, I'm going to just answer that. The dildo definitely came first.
It came first. Okay. All right. Good. So I grew up in a radio family. My dad was on WGN radio for 33 years. So radio was on all the time. I know about the history of radio. I did not know the history of conservative radio. That is, I mean, you know, we know Rush Limbaugh, you know, and where that went. And then I produced a show about him. But tell us about that in terms of your research with the dynamic between conservatives and liberals.
So if folks are interested in this, Nicole Hemmer, who's a professor of history and political history, she wrote this amazing book called Messengers of the Right about the history of conservative talk radio. And you have these. You know, Father Coughlin, who had this sort of fire and brimstone radio show that's like simultaneously like Christian and segregationist and anti-communist, you know, the happy trifecta. Clarence Mannion also had a radio show. And these were radio shows that were sprinkled across radio stations all around the country. And their cultural power was actually pretty intense. What people don't understand, though, is that those shows were funded. They weren't like grassroots, organic, you know, media products. They were usually funded by ideological, pro-capitalist, like, you know, rich guys. So in one case, it was like a dog food millionaire. And in the other case, it was like a candy magnate or something. But these were strategically designed to instill cultural values on the conservative side across sort of the heartland, really, because that's where these radio shows were really popular. What I think is super wild, and the way that I start Irony and Outrage, my first book, is I look at the fact that the same exact things were happening, well, different things were happening across the left and the right. In the 1950s and 60s, as these radio shows are happening, and as it's, you know, this segregationist, white, Christian, anti-communist shtick, you know, this is how you have to think about these things. The world is going to hell in a handbasket. And it's really didactic. And it sounds just like the Fox News people from today. At the same moment that that's happening, you have Lenny Bruce and his ilk doing this sort of radical experimental satire in not just comedy clubs, but, you know, Lenny Bruce was in like strip clubs and in these kind of literally underground places, kind of creating this entirely new aesthetic of political query, which is what it was, which then became adopted by folks, you know, like the committee and other folks who then became instrumental in creating the sort of comedic ethos of that time, right? So you end up with folks who ended up writing at the Smothers Brothers, who then were responsible for kind of radicalizing the Smothers Brothers, which didn't go over well with CBS. But what I love about this is that these stories are happening at the same time. One is very top down, very didactic. The other is very grassroots, experimental, radical, playful. You know, you got performance artists, you got ironic satirists. And those, if you take those two storylines all the way through, the right ends up becoming Fox News and Rush Limbaugh, and the left ends up becoming Colbert, The Daily Show, and, you know, the satire that we know today. And when you take the effects of exposure to those two genres today, you actually end up with kind of parallel outcomes. Obviously quite different in terms of the attitudes that are affected and how they're changed and the way that these programs set our agendas. But whether you're looking at like Fox News or The Daily Show or whatever, those audiences who consume those things are having issues brought to the top of their mind. They're having issues framed for them a certain way. They tend to use these shows to not just learn about the world, but to create meaning, to create understanding. They're super politically participatory. They talk about politics a lot. Da, 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 da. So I kind of make the argument that like these are the natural sort of extensions of those psychological profiles I had spoken of earlier, where of course you're going to have people who are really monitoring for threats in their environment, cultural conservatives who like routine and order and straight talk and hyperbole. They're going to be really drawn to both creating and consuming the kind of outrage stuff we get from like Fox, right? Or Rush Limbaugh versus that sort of playful, experimental. I don't tell you exactly what to think, but I create juxtapositions that invite you to play and come to certain conclusions. That is very much in keeping with a liberal sort of psychology.
So this duality seems to support Kirk Gray's stuff on outrage that, and we had him on the podcast, and that this idea of like, we're coming from the moral harm, which exists in both areas. And I know the founders of the committee, the founders of Second City and Del Close, and I worked with them, and they were mad too. They just expressed it in this other way.
Exactly. I mean, that isn't that in itself fascinating? And this is one of the things that we struggle with in social science, because the same things, the same underlying physiological processes manifest in different behaviors. And so you might be like, oh, well, they're different. But are they different? Or are they coming from... Right? Are they coming from the same thing, but they become articulated differently because of these different, both cultural norms around how we express ourselves on the left and the right, but also just the way that we think about threat and the way that we think about what is the best way to engage in inquiry and expression. And I think for the left, it's very experimental. Right.
Yeah.
This is something that is so fascinating to me right now, Kelly, because of where we're at with this administration and funding for science and medicine and higher ed and all these cuts that are being enacted. You know, there's so many allegations about higher ed being politically biased and like science is biased and all this stuff is biased. If you think about the ethos of science, which is very much, we never remove ourselves from doubt. We are never content with the feeling that we're right. We're never certain. We're always hypothesis testing. We're always open to the possibility we could be wrong. Science is improv.
Sure.
Science is yes and, constant yes and. Constantly being open to the possibility that there's another piece out there. The scene's never done.
Never.
Right? So I don't think, it's not that science comes from a bunch of like, you know, politically liberal folks who like have an axe to grind. I think there is something inherent in the scientific process that is a lot more compatible with a liberal psychology. And so we shouldn't be surprised. You end up with a whole lot of folks in these spaces that do tend to be politically liberal. And the solutions and the explanations that they find are systemic, right? A scientist kind of goes big and starts thinking like, okay, well, if this is how this plays out, we should really think about how we could solve this. Those kinds of approaches to questions are going to tend to be a little more liberal.
This is interesting because, okay, I just interviewed Charles Piller for the podcast, and he has a book coming out called Doctored, which is uncovering this massive uncovering of fraudulent Alzheimer's research.
Going wild. Yeah.
Oh, it's terrible. Book was fascinating. I think I knew I knew what was happening in the moment. And I work with a lot of scientists. And so I am not anti-science. The author stressed, he's like, I'm not anti-science. I'm a science writer, but this is a problem. And I decided to listen to Derek Thompson's podcast, Plain English, which I really like. And Derek, and I know Derek from The Atlantic and doing stuff with them. He interviewed Charles but he saved the last 3 minutes for basically a personal, like, look, I know what's happening right now. I think this is an important podcast, but don't want you to use this to, you know, defund good research that's happening in cancer and heart disease and strokes and even Alzheimer's. And I didn't do that for my podcast. I'm sitting here driving going, oh, did I screw up by not bookending that? And then I thought about it, and I'm like, I know my audience. I know the context of anyone who listens to this. I don't need to. And Derek has a bigger audience that is probably more crossover.
Yeah. Yeah. That's really that. You know what, though? Kudos to you for kind of reflecting on that and wondering, like, should I have framed this a certain way? Like, because we talked about the meaning of any communication once it's out there. Yeah. It doesn't reside in the creator. It's out there. But this is the risk with, I mean, anytime you're doing scientific research, one of the things that is, I call it the rhetorical disadvantage of science, that because science is never done and nothing is ever proven and everything is caveats, our media environment really punishes that kind of stuff. Our media environment really likes strong, clear, confident answers, right? So if you're someone who has reported on fraudulent research and lies in the Alzheimer's world, The media environment, generally speaking, especially the televisual media environment, is going to want to pressure you to put a period on the end of that. That is, scientists are liars. We cannot trust what comes out of this machinery. And, you know, in order to approach these questions really honestly, it requires that humility of being, this is one isolated case. It suggests that it can happen, but we need safeguards in place. And the vast majority of scientific inquiry is done by people who are truly invested in coming to some kind of truth. Do we know for sure that everyone doing it is doing it the right way? No. But the problem then, Kelly, is that once you open that door, because of the demand for certainty, once you open that door, there's going to be a real pull to be like, therefore, it's all shit.
Yeah. Yeah. You're post-truth at that point.
Yeah. Yeah.
It is shocking to me that we don't know each other.
Right? So weird.
This like, who on earth is like an improv comedy nerd and behavioral science nerd who's talks about Colbert? It's ridiculous. And so I learned about you on the Hidden Brain show.
Yeah.
Because we share something sad too. You know, we've both experienced great loss.
Yeah.
And my audience knows about what we went through with my daughter Nora, because I kept recording all through that. So it was during the process, the year, and then after she passed. And our work saved me.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Because I do think that creative truth seeking and meaning making, which is what we're both doing, is therapeutic. There's an author named Penny Baker who writes about the healing properties of rewriting one's own story.
Yeah. Yeah.
And just how powerful that is for to create resilience, because, you know, people have different levels of resilience, but if you actively take your pain and you build things out of it, not just arbitrary things, but things that tap into that pain and try to create meaning from the pain, I do think that it's healing, especially if you allow yourself to somehow stay in a space that where you can tap into that grief. Like for Nora, in my case, my late husband, Mike, who was the my director of Comedy Sports Philadelphia, who helped found the company in 99. If you can keep yourself in a space where you're always flirting with ideas that that person would have enjoyed or would have been so excited for you knowing that you're doing it, it keeps them right here in your work, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's and like the grief journey, the trauma journey, all of it is a little bit different. But the thing that when Anne and I reflect on this, what we know, and the science backs us up, is it's our connections to humans that was the game changer.
Sure.
And Colbert is a great example of this, because, you know, like he and Anne texted every day. And I've talked about this, I think, before, but we held the memorial here at Second City for Noor. And we didn't know this, but Colbert recorded two shows in one night and then chartered a plane so all our friends who were writers on the show and he could be here.
Wow.
And then stayed with us, you know, the rest of the day and the rest of the night, sitting in our backyard, crying, talking, crying more. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he is... If you know, he is also touched by tragedy, and you know, it was just like, you know, and it was more than that, but it was definitely, you know, and you have this rich community that you were also drawing from. So I imagine that was kind of true for you.
And still true. I mean, the way, you know, improv is so great because you can just do improv until you're dead. So our company has about 50 active members right now, players, and we just had auditions and we took a new class and they're so funny. Oh my God. I'm like, I don't think I was ever that I feel like they're always getting funnier. Or maybe I'm just getting old. I don't know. But when I went to rehearsal and there were probably 30 players there because it was welcoming the new players. And it was so cool because, like, you know, 15 of them are people I've known for 25 years, who many of whom were best friends with Mike Young, my late husband, before I was in the company.
Yeah.
Many of them were at my wedding. And Mike passed away. It'll be 20 years in 2026. And I've continued performing and rehearsing with these people, and the company's grown and it's gotten bigger and better. And we're offering all kinds of new shows and productions, and he would be so psyched. But to have that community continue to be with me such that, you know, we go out afterwards and I can make a joke about Mike, and my friend Dave is like, oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Mike would have blah, blah, blah. And it's like, he's still right there.
Yeah.
And that is just, it's just so amazing. I often picture myself being in, you know, I picture myself like in a circus tent and, you know, there's a huge high wire and there's that net. But the net for me is like all these friends, like 30 years of friends who are just the net. And I picture it all the time. It's, we're pretty blessed, you know?
Yeah, I'm very grateful. All right, in a moment, I'm going to ask you for a yes and story, which is a effing layup for you. But okay. But before we do that, I want to mention this because we talked about the difference between Comedy Sports and Second City a little bit. So Comedy Sports, very game-based. If you've watched Whose Line Is It Anyway, you know, that's very much kind of the thing. And what Second City does is improvise, premise-based improvisation towards scenes. But the training is the same, mm-hmm. and the training is the games. And Sheldon Patinkin, I don't know if that's a name you know.
Yeah.
Sheldon is, while not a founder, he was here at the beginning. And then when Paul Sills left, who was the founding artistic director, Sheldon took over. And then he became the chair of the theater department at Columbia College. He noted all of Mike Nichols' work, whether it was plays or movies, because he you know, was with Nichols and May in that period. So, and he's passed. He's my wife's mentor. But one of the things that he said that is 1,000% true for all of these different domains that touch on improvisation is when you play the games, you become an ensemble.
Yeah, that's it.
And it is powerful.
Because and it's instant.
It's instant. But being an ensemble is not easy. And there's all kinds of norms and rules that many maybe go unspoken. But like what we know foundationally is if we can't get to that ensemble, and you can think about this in your world as your team.
That's interesting. Yeah.
If you can't get there, you don't really have a team. You don't have an ensemble.
Sure.
No, I love that idea. I mean, just taking it back to that, you know, rehearsal the other week when it was the first time that these new players had shown up, and you know, you walk in, you're like, oh my gosh, these people, they're so young. They're like in their early 20s. I'm not going to have anything in common with them. And then we start playing the games and it's like, oh no. Mm-hmm. They're funny as hell. They're looking me right in the eye. They're like already good listeners. They're like, no, we are an ensemble already. Like it's happening. It's like happening right now. It's magic.
Yeah. It's a thing of beauty. And here's the thing. It's not magic. It's a practice.
That's true. It feels magic.
It does feel magic. And it does. And I don't want to destroy that feeling. It's like that.
Sure, I talk about this
in all my talks. However, it's important to know that if it isn't practiced, you can't get there.
True.
Because I think people do think creatives are magic. And it's like, no, we work really hard at this.
My favorite, though, is when folks are like, I don't understand. You're going to rehearsal for your,
for your improv show.
Yeah. I'm like, yes. That's how it works.
It's like, do you go to a baseball game and see that they go play catch before they play the game?
Yeah.
They do that for a reason.
Exactly.
All right. So we always end the podcast with a yes and story. What you got for us?
So mine is my favorite because I had moved to Philadelphia to go to graduate school at Penn and I was 22 and little, you know, rural kid from New Hampshire, scared to death. Philly is a little overwhelming. And I found out that there were going to be auditions for this, you know, improv company. I'd done improv for 4 years as an undergrad. I'd done theater sports and I had done a long form company as well in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. And I was like, oh my gosh, I'm going to audition for this. So I did. I auditioned. I got the call back. And then it was my late husband who called me in my dorm room to say, congratulations, you've been cast. And I hadn't even started my classes at the University of Pennsylvania yet. And I was like, oh my gosh. And I told him, I'm sorry, I actually can't join the company. Yeah, I'm like, I am actually a pretty rigid person who needs a lot of order. Improv has helped me a lot, but that is kind of how I am. And he was like, I do not understand this. He's like, literally, you need to explain where the rehearsals were and whatever. He's like, just get on the subway. I'm like, I can't take the subway. Subway seems scary. He's like, just take the subway. Just come to the first one. And then see where you get. Just the first one. And I promised him I would. And I did. And here we are, 25 years later. And I'm still in that company. And I married that man. And we had a baby boy who's now a junior in college. So.
Does he improvise?
He does not. And I have wanted it so bad. I think I've wanted it too much, Kelly. He's like, no, I'm not. No, mom. No, he's like, he plays tennis. He's a runner. He does statistics. He's a stats major. He's like a cool kid. He's not like me.
So our 27-year-old is a Shakespeare actor.
Oh, well, that's nice.
Yeah. I mean, both Nick and Nora took classes at Second City. They were both excellent improvisers and very funny. But Nick, like, got to college, and he auditioned for the improv troupe, which he didn't get in, which was political, because they all know, they knew us. Completely, like, it was a bet. And then he's like, I love text. I love Shakespeare. So he moved to Atlanta. He's part of the Shakespeare Theater there. And it's...
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Oh, that's amazing. Yeah. That's amazing. So one of the other founders of Comedy Sports Philadelphia, he and his wife, we met through Comedy Sports. They had two boys. And I remember, you know, taking care of them when they were little babies. Well, that one of those young men just auditioned and got cast in the company. So now we're performing with multiple generations. Oh, no. And it is amazing.
That's
amazing. Yeah.
Oh, such a great conversation. So, Danielle Goldthwait Young, her books are Irony and Outrage and Wrong. They're both fantastic. Check them out. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you so much, Kelly. I can't wait to meet you in person. We just have to figure out when.
Getting the Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Colleen Fahey, Mike Farinaccio, and Emma Smith. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
Adulthood, no one survives.